Well, we're going to be looking at 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 to 4 this evening. So, I exhort the elders who are among you, as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker of the glory that is to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. There are little words in the Bible that can be so important, and they can open up great windows into the text. And in our text this evening, there are words that you get your eyes immediately drawn to, and elders, shepherds, overseers, chief shepherds, crowns. And we couldn't miss a very little and yet vital word in this text, and it's the word so. Now, I've never ever noticed that word before. I've often turned to 1 Peter chapter 5 as a go-to passage about how elders are supposed to do their work, how church governance is laid out for us. But this word, so, it's brought a whole new dimension to the text to me. Why is Peter urging elders to do their work faithfully and eagerly? Is it just because he wants everything neat and tidy in the church? Well, there's something more, isn't there, when you add the word so? Because the word so links it back to what we were looking at last time in chapter 4. And in chapter 4, we've been told that there's this great fiery trial which is about to be let loose on the church. Nero, away in Rome, where Peter is. He talks about those in Babylon greeting you. I think Peter's in Rome at the time. Nero is beginning to persecute the Christians after the great fire of Rome. And what he's doing there is beginning now to spread across the Roman Empire. And so it's really important that you young churches, Peter says, far away in northern Turkey, that you're ready. You're equipped, you're led, you're cared for. So when this trial reaches you, which it's going to, you'll be ready. And you'll not only be able to stand, but you'll be able to triumph and grow and glorify God in the midst of it. These are probably very, very young churches. You look at your maps in the back of your Bible, Paul's missionary journeys, and you'll notice that Paul never got as far north in his missionary journeys as these regions. Peter clearly knew these churches. Maybe he had visited them. Maybe he knew Christians who had gone to evangelize this area, or perhaps other Christians who'd been displaced from churches further south in the empire and pushed up into the north of Turkey. But it seems as though these churches in Pontus and all the other areas are in their developmental stages still. They're not established properly. Maybe they're still in the embryonic stages of church life. You notice that Peter writes to the elders who are among you. That's quite an unusual way to write. You would have thought if he was writing to an established church, he would write to the elders who are over you, who are already doing the work of eldership in the church. But he talks about the elders who are among you, scattered among you, not yet necessarily properly functioning as elders. And you could translate the words shepherd the flock of God very accurately as start shepherding the flock. And Peter's saying to these churches, now look, this is serious. We're going to be facing this great challenge later in the chapter. Satan is prowling around and he's seeking to devour as he's stalking the church. He's looking to pick the stragglers off. So come on, elders, start doing your work. Get the flock together and look after them. He's already told them that they're to be united in mind. That they're to start using the gifts that they've been given by Jesus in the service of each other. So in other words, it is time for these young Christians to grow up, to grow together, and to start working together. And as the storms begin to gather away in the west, Peter's encouraging the would-be leaders of the church because they're going to be the first in the firing line. When the storm comes and the police are rounding up the Christians, they're going to be knocking on the doors of the elders first. And this is going to sort out the hirelings that Jesus talks about, who at the first moment of danger are hightailing it away as far as they can, and those who are going to stand. And I think it's lovely that Peter at this point writes to them, not as the great apostle. He's told us in chapter 1, verse 1, that that's what he is. But he writes to these probably fearful men as a sympathising, understanding fellow elder. It's Peter, with all his scars that tell the stories of his weakness and yet the greater stories of Jesus' all-sustaining grace, who puts that large fisherman's arm around his friends. And as we're trembling as elders and thinking, I really don't think I can do this. I don't think I could lead the church in perilous times. I don't think I could lead the church through lockdowns. I'm not sure I'm up to this, Peter would be able to say, and nor am I. I thought I was once. But I came to realise that I wasn't by myself. And then I had to learn really to follow Jesus. And I started to trust him and to listen to him. And that's what you need to do. And what he says to elders is relevant to all of us as the church. Because think about this. If Jesus' answer to the fiery trial, which is about to come on the church, is to set up ordinary New Testament churches, then they must be amazing things, these ordinary New Testament churches. Peter doesn't say, look, the fiery trial's coming. You need to get down as quickly as possible to Guns R Us. Stock up on AK-47s. He says, no, a great trial's coming. And the only thing that's going to stand is a biblical New Testament church. Well, like I say, there must be something extraordinary about a local church seeking to follow the apostles' teachings. So firstly, let's look at what the elders are to do. They are to shepherd the flock of God, which is among them, exercising oversight. And this word oversight becomes a little bit of a contentious word later on in church history because it's the word that bishops is derived from. But Peter, he wouldn't have had a clue about or any interest in men dressing up in fancy clothes and wearing pointy hats. That's not even on his radar. He gets this word from his Greek version of the Old Testament. He gets it from Ezekiel chapter 34, verse 11. For thus says the Lord, behold, I myself will search for my sheep and I will oversee them. I will shepherd them. So this word for overseer that gets translated bishop is really just another word for shepherd. And all these titles, shepherds, overseers, pastors, elders, they just seem to be interchangeable terms in the New Testament. It makes things a lot easier for us. But Peter's mind would most firmly have been drawn back to a day when he was walking with Jesus at this point on a beach just after Jesus' resurrection, and where Jesus said in the simplest and yet the most profound way exactly what he wanted Peter to do for the rest of his life. And he said to Peter, "Peter, do you love me more than these?" And Peter had said, "Well, yes, Lord, do you know that I love you?" And Jesus had said to him, "I want you to feed my lambs." And Peter, "Do you love me?" "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." "Well then, I want you to tend my sheep." "Peter, do you love me?" "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." "Well then, I want you to feed my sheep." For the rest of your days, Peter, this is to be your task. It is to shepherd the flock of God. You're to look after her. And it's what he's been doing. And it's what he's doing here as he calls on yet more men to shepherd the flock of God which is among you. "These are my sheep," says Jesus. "My lambs." This is the flock of God. The church is the most precious thing in the whole of the world and the whole of history. She belongs to God, the flock of God. She is the apple of God's eye. She is his love gift to his son. She is the bride of his son. The church is God's inheritance in the saints. She is the flock that was ransomed by the blood of the Son of God. She's the temple of the Holy Spirit. She's the one that God has given himself to and that God has taken for himself, the flock of God. That's you, my brothers and sisters. I wish we could really grasp just how glorious it is to be the church, to be the flock of God. For Jesus to be looking at us this evening and saying, "These are my lambs. These are my sheep." And so he says to the elders, "Now look, I want you to shepherd this priceless flock." That means, for a start, feeding them, doesn't it? With the word. Feeding them with what satisfies them and nourishes them, warms their hearts, makes their faces radiant sometimes, which convicts them, and yet always comforts them. What the elders are to do is to fix the eyes of the flock onto Jesus so that flagging spirits can be revived and they can go out into another week and persevere, and knees that are buckling can be strengthened. You want the flock to be able to taste and see just how good God is. And if you're an elder, you have to be tasting and seeing just how good he is. Because there's little that is more dispiriting than preaching an unfelt Christ. That is one of the most terrifying things, preaching a sermon that hasn't touched you when you're preparing it. How can you expect it to even begin to work in someone else? Sometimes to God's amazing grace it does, but you want to preach a felt Christ and you want them to taste and see how good he is. You want to lead them in paths of righteousness. If you're going to shepherd God's flock, you've got to protect the flock. Pick them up when they fall, because we all do. And then go and find them when they wander. The elders are to pray over them and for them. The church will bring the elders the greatest joy as they see them growing in grace, pressing on through trials. There have been times when I've argued with God and said, no, that's not fair what you're doing in that person's life. That's you've just piled too many trials onto them. What are you doing? And then I see them just growing and grace triumphing in their lives. And I have to go back to Jesus and say, yeah, you did know. You were right again. You really are forming Christ in them. They'll bring such heartache when you see the flock cold and uninterested and backslidden and fractious. And sometimes the church will give the elders a very hard time, and sometimes we'll think we deserve it. We'll often get things wrong. Peter did, didn't he? Even as an elder, even as an apostle, he was still adept at falling flat on his face, but he's still learning, as we all are. We've still got growing to do, but you don't give up on the flock and you don't stop loving them, because Jesus didn't. These are his lambs, his sheep. And part of shepherding them will also be preparing for the future as well. I think back to when I was at my previous church and I went to see an elder who had been there from the very beginning of the time that Bradford had had an eldership. He was dying in hospital and we were talking about everything, especially about Jesus. And I asked him about the church. And I said, what do you think the greatest problem is that we face as a church at the moment? And without any hesitation, he said, inertia. We're standing still. We're not thinking about the future. We're not planning for the... We're happy where we are. And we have to make plans for the future. We can have a spirit of Hezekiah, can't we? When he learns that there's going to be great disaster in the future, but he's going to be gone before that. We can look at the calendar and think, well, I'll be gone before that happens. Now you judge an elder's work or a pastor's work, not just by what goes on at the time, but by what they leave behind. They have to make preparation for the future. Shepherd the flock of God. Love them, feed them, guide them, lead them. Pray over them. Secondly, how do you do it? Well, Peter says with three couplets, as one has, each one has a negative and a positive. And the first is exercise oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you. And that speaks to the whole church here, not just to elders, because if the third couplet, elders are to be examples to the rest of the church, then their willingness to do whatever needs to be done in the church ought to be infectious in a good way to the rest of the church, an example to the church. Oh, I struggle with this because there are things that I'm compelled to do, which are duties. They come round with alarming regularity. And I can't afford to wait for the sense of duty to be swallowed up by the joys and the delights. I'd still be waiting to preach my very first sermon if I waited for duty simply to become pure delight. I don't wake up on Sunday morning every week thinking, great, it's Sunday and it's double pull. And then skip my way down Grange Road and burst in here. I come in here under a great sense of burden, usually. But Peter's genius here is he doesn't leave it with how we feel about doing something. But who do we do it for? You notice he goes on to say, as God would have you. That's lovely, because that gets you going again. I'm to prepare this sermon. I'm to preach this sermon. I'm to take this prayer meeting. I'm to go to this prayer meeting. I'm to attend another meeting as God would have me do. I think about how Jesus did the costly and the mundane, always so willingly, didn't he? He doesn't say to his disciples, "Well, lads, what's on the itinerary for today? Oh, we've got to cross over the Sea of Galilee and there's going to be a storm. And then we're going to get to the other side, to Gadara, and there's going to be that demon-possessed man come hurtling down the hillside." And Jesus says, "Well, is there any option B, maybe, that we could do today?" He's, "No, lads, in the boat. This is wonderful. We can glorify my Father and we can do good to other people here. We can bring his blessing to others." And as we see Jesus doing that, as God would have us, and I and all of you can be thinking, if this, whatever it is we're asked to do, is important to God, if it brings blessing to his flock and glory to his name, then I will to do this. And I find, I'm sure you're the same, that invariably, as we do it like that, duty just gets swallowed up in delight and joy. As he really does give grace to help in our times of need and strength that sustains us. Then the next couplet is not for shameful gain, but eagerly. Not for what you can get out of it, a reputation, a certain importance, a glory, wealth, fame, even in the rather small goldfish bowl, which is 21st century evangelicalism in the United Kingdom. We could be passionate about having a reputation, a glory. I remember when we were going through 2 Corinthians, Paul has to compare himself with the super teachers who've gone to Corinth. He hates doing it, but he will do it. And he asks the Corinthian church the question. He says, "Do you think that the church is there for the super teacher's benefit? Or do you think the teachers are there for the church's benefit?" And clearly Paul could see that the Corinthian church simply existed for the benefit of making the super teachers look better and better. And Paul has to say to them, "Come on, they make slaves of you. They don't free you to follow Jesus. They encapture you to follow them. They devour you. They feed off of you. They take advantage of you. They strike you." And Paul says, "We were far too weak to do that." He served the church. He took blows from the church. Not for shameful gain, not for what you can get out of it, but eagerly. That's an even stronger word than willingly, isn't it? Eager to be of service in the kingdom of God. Not domineering over those in your charge, those entrusted to you, but as examples to the flock. It was John Dalberg Acton who said, "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men." He wrote it, I guess, after observing politics for a number of years. Although the fact that he wrote that to an archbishop suggests he might have been observing church politics for a number of years. And it isn't so difficult for elders to become mini despots and tyrants, and to flatter and threaten and manipulate and brief against and undermine. Thank God the greatest man was not a bad man, but a good man, a humble man, a man who on a number of occasions had to deal with the mini Napoleons that were in Peter's heart and James's and John's and the others. Because often, as you read through Matthew, Mark and Luke, too often, you find them arguing about which was the greatest, don't you? Matthew 20, verse 25. This isn't the first time he's had to do this. Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know, the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you, but whoever will be great among you must be your servant, and whoever will be first among you must be your slave. Even as the Son of Man came, not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Not domineering, not lording it over, but examples of eager, willing service. Models of humility. This is what we'll be going on to next week, as Peter just develops this a bit further. And humility is not weakness. It's Jesus-likeness. Those are the sorts of shepherds that Jesus wants for his church. They're the sorts of shepherds this church needs. But thirdly, why would we do it? Verse 4, "And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory." I say, why would we do it? Is it for the crown? Well, no, it's for the king, isn't it? Because there is this chief shepherd who owns the flock and who loves the flock and who died for them. And whilst he might delegate responsibilities onto under shepherds to look after the flock, and he's going to hold us to account, this Jesus will never abdicate his responsibility over the whole flock. And that must have been exciting. That must have been encouraging for these elders and these Christians in northern Turkey, that as Nero's storm began to build up and to rumble in from the west, they knew they weren't alone. That above them, and above Nero, and above the cosmic powers in heavenly places, stood the chief shepherd, keeping watch over his flock. Though we go through the valley of the shadow of death, we shall fear no evil. Not because our elders are looking after us, but because he is with us. And his rod and staff, they will comfort us. And Nero, he only had breath because Jesus allowed it. And there was a today and a tomorrow only for the sake of the church, the flock of God that Jesus and the Spirit had not yet gathered in from the nations and presented to the Father. But one day, today will be the last day. There won't be a tomorrow, because this chief shepherd, Peter says, will appear now, not as the man of sorrows, but as the Lord of glory. And as every knee bows and every tongue confesses that Jesus is Lord, hear this unimaginably majestic, powerful Jesus, from whose face the whole cosmos has fled, is now putting crowns that are unfading onto the heads of these little shepherds who sought to follow him. And not just them. Because the Apostle Paul, at the end of his life, was able to say, "Henceforth there's laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have longed for his appearing." He comes not to beat his flock. He died for her. And he comes again now to coronate her with unfading crowns. And all he asked us to be was faithful New Testament churches, loving him, loving each other, and serving together with the gifts that he's given for his glory. And we were to do this, remember chapter 4, by the grace that he supplies and by the strength that he gives. So having given the gifts to us, and having given the grace to us, and having given the strength to do it, and having given his love into our hearts, he then comes and puts crowns on our heads for just being what he enabled us to be. That's grace on top of grace on top of grace, isn't it? What a king to serve. What a shepherd to have. What a church to be part of.